I just can't have any social life right now.
Don't worry about it. We're just having coffee. We'll be antisocial.
Welcome, listeners, to another Damn Fine Espresso. In a recent episode, we talked a lot about David Lynch and three of his films in detail. And this is a sort of mini second chances, the episodes where we usually give another chance to a movie that we previously maybe didn't care for as much. And this is also dedicated to a David Lynch film, Wild at Heart. And joining me for this discussion is Alan. Hey there, Alan.
Hello.
From sweltering Bern to sweltering London, welcome to this episode. Now I remember distinctly how you had not such good feelings about Wild at Heart previously. So can you tell us a little bit what your difficulties with the films maybe were, or your previous experience, and why we're sitting here going to talk about this movie in particular?
I mean, I think any discussion on this comes with the caveat that finding a film, a weaker David Lynch film, doesn't mean it's a bad film. You know, his sort of less successful films are still worth watching. They're still very entertaining. And so I think Wild at Heart is one that I sort of come back to when sort of rediscovering Lynch, gorging on Lynch, and just finding some of his films genius. And then Wild at Heart is the one I watch that, for whatever reason, doesn't trigger the same reaction. It sort of feels like a sort of lesser David Lynch film. And it's something I can't quite get to grips with. But it's also something that if I meet people who don't like David Lynch, that they do exist, I think this is the sort of reference point they have. This is the sort of tale, the type of film that I think they're thinking of. And so I think I can sort of understand some of that negativity towards it. Although, again, always comes with a caveat, I don't think it's a bad film.
Well, for me, Wild at Heart is a bit of a different story, because I think now in retrospect, and also watching again, it was the very first David Lynch movie I ever saw. And I saw it repeatedly. I mentioned this in the other episode. It was one of my sister's favorite. We watched Blue Velvet and Wild at Heart repeatedly and talked about it repeatedly. So this is like coming back to a film that I saw many, many times in my teenage, but have not seen since. So I was very curious to sit down with you and talk about it now, because watching it, obviously, a lot came back to me. This was a very familiar movie experience and a very familiar filmic journey for me. And I remember, you know, finding it very interesting to analyze at the time and to talk about David Lynch's, you know, storytelling and the themes that are in there, maybe also the parallels between the two, three movies that we were watching over and over again. And yeah, a lot came up again, and I was aware, or became aware, how familiar I am with that film in many details, up to like lines of dialogue and so on. So I was very curious to see what my reaction would be then as a film seeing it now.
Yeah.
But maybe you can go a little bit into specifics. So if you say a lesser David Lynch film, what were the parts where you felt that, especially maybe in the storytelling, in the characters, in the standout scenes, standalone scenes that I think this film has as well? So can you pinpoint that a little bit?
I think it commits to me probably a bit of a cardinal sin that David Lynch rarely does. I do find it a bit boring. I think it's a bit long. I think when you get to the second half of the film, I kind of feel a lot that what is great about this film, which is especially just the look of the two leads, these sort of sexy outlaws on the run and their hideous mother, they're brilliant. And you get those at the beginning, they're full on at the beginning. Then it can't sustain it. And so by the sort of second half of the film, it feels like it's running out of steam. And that's something I don't think is common for David Lynch. I think he sort of is very good at sucking you into the world, his world, and sort of unsettling you, but engaging you. And it's probably the absence of that that I really sort of feel when watching this film. And it then becomes just an exercise in, oh, I quite like this bit, I like this bit, I like this bit, but nothing that feels like a coherent film.
Yeah, I was wondering, because to me it seemed, now watching it this time, like a very straightforward Lynch story. you know, kind of, I think the road movie underlying structure helped in thinking that this is probably an accessible David Lynch film, because it has, you know, the introduction of the two leads, the reason why they have to leave or go on this road trip together. And then you have, you string along the different scenes and flashbacks and meetings they have with the different characters, the different side characters along this road trip. So to me, it seemed very accessible and I could follow it easily. So I thought maybe this is actually a good introductory David Lynch film. But then, as you said, there are a lot of people who minded this if this was the first film by David Lynch they saw. So do you find it less accessible then for viewers or for like the storytelling itself?
I mean, I think it's a really good point, because there are elements that I agree with you that this would work as a first one. It's got a very easy to catch plot. And like I said, the two leads are gorgeous. They're both you can't stop looking at them. They're both like incredible in this. So that again is a very easily accessible hook. I think when you read sort of criticisms of it, it is the sort of level of violence in it. It is some of the issues that it raises and the extent to which they're incredibly jarring. And I feel that I can defend that in other David Lynch films when he brings up subjects, quite serious subjects like extreme violence or abuse or even rape, that I feel he can justify this. Where I think in this film, it feels like it's thrown in there to be part of just a very in-your-face, oh, look at what we've put, which is horrible. And that then puts it similar, and I won't condemn it completely as being the same type of film, but that's edging dangerously close to Natural Born Killers to me. That you have this idea that, oh, we're going to be edgy, we're going to be dark, we're going to be dangerous, so we throw all these things in it. And I find it quite hard to not take against this film because of that. It just feels like it isn't quite as controlled in raising these issues. And because of that, it feels just like, oh, we're going to be shocking. Guess what we're going to do now? We're going to shock you with these like heavy issues. And I do react sort of, I don't want to sound like an old man, but I do sort of react against that. That makes me feel, oh, well, if you couldn't handle these subjects, why are you bringing them up?
Mm-hmm. I do have two things to say here, but I think this, I didn't mind it as much because I was kind of prepared for it. I read about the reactions that audiences had, and obviously I had seen most of the violence before. So I think it was hard to relate to me to the first time viewing, but obviously there was this discussion around the time, right? Was he doing something that Tarantino was doing later on very often, this shocking level of violence, or that Oliver Stone is doing? And I think I minded it less because it still seemed to not just go in a, you know, horrible direction in the course of the film. Obviously, for the characters who are suffering from violence, it is. But let's say the film was not going down a very dark path to a very depressing, violent conclusion. I think the violence still had meaning. And I think that's what the discussion around Wild at Heart was, that is there violence in Lynch that is meaningful? And I think that was always the thing that they said about his films, contrary to Tarantino or Oliver Stone, where I feel that I find them much more jarring and problematic if I see it, especially in Oliver Stone. There with Natural Born Killers, I had real issues and kind of that the movie disgusted me as an experience. Whereas here I can see it as these outbursts of, yeah, exaggerated violence, exaggerated images. But then it's also at least very darkly cartoonish at times. I find especially those extreme characters. I think Santos, the gangster that helps the mother track down her daughter and her lover, is an example of this. The violence that he uses. Obviously the shootout at the end with Willem Dafoe and what happens to him. I think to a certain extent it had a very darkly, it's hard to say darkly comical, but it seemed like absurd. So it made me rather laugh than, you know, shudder in disgust and you know, be up in arms about the level of violence. But that's just my reaction this time. And I was obviously cushioned in knowing what that would happen. So maybe that's the difference.
I mean, I think there's probably something that I rewatching it sort of as a second chances, especially after sort of binging on quite a bit of Lynch, I did find myself being more able to give it the benefit of the doubt when it came to the violence, because I think it has parallels in other films of his. I think where I probably feel it is a weakness is the level to which the film feels fragmented. And there's stuff in it that I'm not quite sure why. And obviously I think the violence falls into that. But I would like all the Wizard of Oz references throughout this film, I don't quite understand them. They feel very crowbarred into the film. They're almost like product placement that appears in the film. That's sort of like suddenly she's suddenly got ruby slipper style shoes on. She suddenly has a vision of a witch on a broomstick. But it really feels like they had almost made the film and at the last minute thought, let's just chuck in some Wizard of Oz references. They never sort of cohere into anything like, oh, we're seeing a very dark and twisted retelling of the Wizard of Oz. It's a very different story that they've just chucked Wizard of Oz like cameos in, these like little like Easter eggs. And that sort of speaks of a sort of fragmented nature that I find quite hard to get to grips with the film. And then suddenly when I'm not gripped by the film, then a burst of violence, suddenly I think it just feels out of place to me. So, all of these things, although, the Wizard of Oz stuff is in a way it's trivial, I think it speaks to the sort of fragmented nature that then if you then turn around and sort of bring up rape as part of the story, it suddenly feels, oh, where are we going with this? And what's going to happen now? And that sort of feeling continues for the whole film.
I think that the whole Wizard of Oz crowbarring in is confirmed by what I read about the production history. I think the more they got into filming, the more they would come up with references to the Wizard of Oz and put it in. So I think that that's very much the case. I remember really enjoying that when I saw it in my teenage, because, you know, it was an easy way to access references in a film of a different film. And I think that's maybe why Wild at Heart is so, or was so dear in my heart previously, because I remembered all these bits about The Wizard of Oz. And at the same time, of course, I thought it was difficult to make sense of what they meant in relation to The Wizard of Oz. And now seeing it again and knowing about how they ended up in there, it's probably not as deep as I originally thought it was, because seeing it at, I don't know, 14, 15, I probably thought, you know, this has a deeper meaning. There is a clear parallel to maybe the storyline or the motives, the symbols of the Wizard of Oz. Here I thought, yeah, they seemed a little bit more random this time around, even though I thought, you know, the mother as the witch and then obviously the good witch appearing at the end and kind of solving this in a fairy tale kind of way. I mean, there was something magical about it, and this maybe easy distinction of good versus evil. It helped the film in its more absurd, maybe also the violent qualities of it, to say, okay, this is basically a fairy tale, and you have to be aware that there isn't, it's not quite as serious as it appears on the surface, and it's maybe a bit more magical, the sense of also slightly incredible what happens in it. And I think that helped somehow see it more as this labor of, we're telling kind of a fairy tale about those two lovers that have to get together in the end, even though the odds are all against them and they should have no chance with all these gangsters going after them and you know, powerfully violent people going after them, but they still get together. And that somehow I found that very forgivable this time round.
I mean, I still think, and I will say, Diane Ladd in this film is brilliant. I think it's just incredible. It's this sort of bizarre, she's horrible in a way that gangsters and especially women don't get to be horrible in many films. And I think it's an incredible performance. And actually, I'd even say the moment you start trying to draw a parallel with her and say, oh, well, she's the Wicked Witch of the West, it lessens her somewhat. I want her to be this bizarre, complicated, twisted sort of, who she is as a woman is just, there is so much more you could explore in this. There is something really interesting there. she's two-dimensional, but she's two-dimensional in so many different ways that there's, you know, it becomes fascinating. Like, she is evil, but she's not evil. She cares about someone, but then doesn't seem to really be that distraught when they die, sort of a bit sad. And the incredible moment, which is, I think, the best bit of the film, where she just covers her face in red, and you have this beautiful, like, the sound is incredible, and you just see that she's having this strange breakdown as someone who kind of knows that set people to be killed she didn't want killed, and has this twisted desire to look after her daughter that she thinks is in danger. And all of that sort of culminates in this breakdown, which is fantastic. And then what do you do? Well, then you just get her defeated by the good witch turning up at the end and saying, oh, let's just choose love. And I wanted more of her. I wanted more of maybe her, like, succeed. She's a character I'm really engaged in, really interested in. And yeah, if you say, oh yeah, and she's the wicked witch, it actually makes her less, strangely. And I whenever they're throwing in Wizard of Oz references, it feels to me like, oh, you didn't quite know where you were going with this, so this is sort of padding out the film. This is probably a very mean thing to say, but that's how it feels to me. And it's those elements that I really want to get more of. And then it's a bit like, oh no, she's just a wicked witch. And it's just like, oh no, but you had something so much more here.
Mm-hmm. I get that. To me, it just didn't take away from her performance and the impact she had as a character at the same time. You know, the witch stuff was just somewhat enlarging it into something more absurd, but I thought she was still, especially that breakdown at the end that she has over her, you know, 10th glass of martini, and she really just hangs her hair over the martini glass. I mean, it still has that power, and it didn't bother me as much. But talking of Ladd and Cage and Dern, you know, what I really enjoyed also is just the cast of characters all together. I mean, who is in there? I mean, Willem Dafoe with his, you know, weird little fish teeth as Bobby Peru is scary brilliant. I'd somehow forgotten he was in there, strangely enough. And then once he appeared, I was like, of course, this guy. Because to me, these Lynch films were a bit of a blur, and especially Wild at Heart, having not seen it for a long time. And Harry Dean Stanton, you know, it's the good guy who follows Ladd's orders and gets on the tail of Dern and Cage, is just, I mean, he's fantastic in this. And as many people, I love him in all his supporting roles that he's had. This is a very good one for him.
And he's heartbreaking at this.
Yes.
Because, like, he's being lied to by her. And you kind of wonder, does he sort of know he's being lied to, but his love for her is such that he will still go and do what she asks, that he's that much in love, that it's this sort of tragic love that, like, you know, and she basically leads him to his death. This is the fate that happens. And you know, they're quite an interesting couple to counterpoint with Cage and Dern, that he is absolutely blindly adoring of her in the same way that I think Nicolas Cage is of Laura Dern's character. There's this blind adoration that he will do anything for her, he will follow her, but it's just this sort of twisted, dark version of it. And yeah, no, I think it's one of the highlights of the film is when she sort of tracks him down, when Diane Ladd tracks him down, and they're having dinner in the restaurant, and she's sort of going, we need to go, please go, and she's trying to sort of save him, because to some extent she signed his, you know, death certificate.
And it's a denial about it, right? She somehow doesn't want to accept that she is responsible for his death.
And she thinks that maybe if they get away now, it can be saved. And he's there as this sort of innocent lamb, not realizing that, like, you know, he's very close to death. And that scene is incredible. And I think that's really, again, why I say that, like, I don't want to be doing too much down on Wild at Heart, because a weaker David Lynch film is still a pretty good film. It's got moments like this that are just really got that engaging, that unsettling quality, where you suddenly become hooked by these characters. You're engaged by what they're doing. And yet that is just going to be used to make you feel awful and twisted and sad, or in other cases, like with the two leads, like slightly elated. So Harry Dean Stanton's really good in this.
I did enjoy that juxtaposition, especially of, you know, her, the mother, between Harry Dean Stanton's character and then Santos, the gangster, and feeling that somehow Nicolas Cage as Sailor is somehow in between those two characters, right? He's also, like you said, in admiration of Laura Dern, And at the same time, he also has obviously the violent qualities. He kills a guy at the very beginning in a very gruesome way. So he's somehow a mix of those two men, and we don't quite know which he's going to turn into towards the end. So I think that constellation of characters I found interesting. But it was even down to smaller roles. I'm thinking of, you know, Jack Nance, the Lynch regular, who shows up as this guy with his dog, talking about his dog. And that was one of the lines that my sister and I quoted endlessly, you know, my dog is always with me. So there were endlessly quotable things. And one of my favorite set of lines was also around the mother, again, not accepting that Harry Dean Stanton is gone when they tell her that he's gone buffalo hunting. And then she sits in the sofa and she says, he's done it again. The fucker split.
Yeah.
I mean, these are lines that my sister and I were like, we would instantly know. And now talking to her about doing this podcast, I of course asked her what she felt about, you know, watching this. And she had some thoughts as well. But just these are very memorable things. And down to the Twin Peaks characters or the Twin Peaks actresses that show up in this film. Obviously, Isabella Rossellini showing up in this in giving a very, very different impression than she had in Blue Velvet. So I think having these people in bits and pieces, even in bit piece roles, I didn't mind this time. For me, it was like a kaleidoscope of like David Lynch in connection with the films that I had just seen with watching Twin Peaks at the moment. So that somehow I came together for me as a whole. I thought, oh, this is really like good bits and pieces of David Lynch thrown into kind of this road movie. And then we stop for a little while with the car accident, or we stop then in Big Tuna for all these more or less famous scenes, especially the Defoe ones. And, you know, the whole show altogether came together really as something that I truly enjoyed. But I do see how you felt about the bits and pieces that this is, and maybe not something that is very satisfying in the end. What did he make of the whole thing watching it this time in looking back at it?
I mean, I think especially because rewatching a lot of David Lynch recently, very much going through sort of a bit of a binge. And I think when you watch this, I sort of feel I can sort of get to grips with sort of seeing that he's sort of still learning how to tell the stories he really wants to tell. That he's got this take on, you know, genuine surrealism and a taste for like discordant visuals, like something that will be so jarring and uncanny. And he's wanting to sort of work that into what is almost quite mainstream storytelling. It's something I think he's really interested in. And I think it feels like he's not quite there yet with this film. The leaps between the two are to some extent too obvious. There isn't a big picture that you suddenly get absolutely enraptured by. You've got this set of experiences. Some of the experiences feel like, oh, this is like a mainstream, a pulp movie. This is like a road movie, like slightly exploitation 70s, criminals on the run, glamorous looking young people. You've got moments like that. And then set against that, you've got moments like when Harry Dean Stanton, the build up to his death, that feel very sort of Lynchian in their sort of weirdness and darkness. And I don't think he's quite got putting those two sides of him together. And it's sort of interesting that this is sort of around the time of making the pilot for Twin Peaks and before Twin Peaks really goes in front of the camera. Whereas I think, you know, I think that's where he really discovers it. I think the first season of Twin Peaks is where he really gets to work out how to make something that has all these sort of mainstream elements as part of the storytelling that work perfectly alongside surrealism and totally jarring, incredible visuals. And that you can see him being close to that here. And I think the film is definitely worth watching because he's on the road to discovering it, but he's not quite there. And so when you sort of watch it alongside binging so much of his other stuff, you sort of, oh, well, you know, it's an early film. But, you know, you can't be too harsh on early films. A lot of great early films show the promise that then gets developed and they're worth watching because of it.
Well, it's true. This film does not have these sudden twists into the complete absurd, right? There is no sudden identity change. There is no red room where stuff happens that is inexplicable in the realistic world. This one somehow sticks to things that are possible or that are like flashbacks or that are like dream parts.
I mean, the sort of the truly absurd moment is the happy ending.
Yes.
Is the good witch turning up. And there's maybe something in the idea that the original book, so he was going to adapt the book, and the book has apparently a very dark ending that they don't get together, and I think one of them dies. And David Lynch sort of changed that. So he sort of chose to go with the route of a happy ending. And he kind of, to justify the happy ending, you have this flight of fancy. You have this moment that is like truly, it is the absurdest thing in the film. It's just like the good witch comes down from the sky and tells him, don't do what you're going to do. Like it's, I suppose you could argue it's sort of his hallucination because he's just been knocked out. But it is, again, Lynch showing something that, you know, he does do surreal moments, and he can be criticized for like, oh, well, that's just being weird for weird's sake. This feels like, I don't quite know how to end this. So he's been weird for weird's sake to just give us a send off.
Well, I do have I have a real soft spot for, you know, this ending, because it feels it's a kind of a confirmation. And maybe again, in comparison to Tarantino and Oliver Stone, that in a way there's still something like forgiving about Lynch cinema, right? That he kind of says, okay, I'm going to give that fairy tale ending, because I think in his mind these two characters could not be together at the end. I think that was his reasoning, so that he makes these kinds of decisions. And I think we saw that in other films as well. It never ends up in the darkest possible place. It's not a cinema to kind of pull you down completely. It leaves a lot of avenues open. Normally there's a lot more room for interpretation, but the fact that he chose this ending, I thought it felt very good. I felt very good about liking Lynch cinema, because he can in a film like this, that is a bit more straightforward, or a lot more straightforward, is a bit more mainstreamy, that he somehow makes this creative choice, right? To say, there's this ending. These characters are great, and they are. And the ending is cheesy as hell, but somehow it fits, because it didn't seem tucked on to me as much, because I felt it does make sense that with the promise that the film gives, that, or the promises that they try to give each other, right, in the course of the film, with all the stuff that can happen to them, at the end they just end up at the most ideal combination of things, you know, in this musically ending that could be out of La La Land, I guess, where he sings Love Me Tender to her. I mean, it's so cheesy, but the cheesiness has a certain, I mean, it's very endearing that Lynch would make a film like this and end it on that note.
I mean, I guess it's probably the sort of curmudgeon in me that when we talked recently about Blue Velvet, you have in that film that sort of happy ending that feels unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel, maybe I'm just being selfish, I prefer Lynch that does that.
Mm-hmm.
I think an out-and-out happy ending from David Lynch, I can't trust it. I don't know what to do with it. It's too weird.
Yeah, this is not unsettling. Yeah. That's true. I was trying to look for the fake-looking bird or anything. No, it's just an expanded, extended song, and then this is it, right? So obviously you can say it's just a dream, he's just making it up, it doesn't actually happen, if you're, you know, more on the negative side of things, that this is not possible. But he plays it out, and it ends in this very happy Hollywood ending.
And I think if we were meant to question it, I think Lynch would put something in there that suggests maybe this isn't, that he's hallucinating this lying on the street, having basically been beaten to a pulp by a gang. You know, he doesn't do that. It's just in your face, a happy ending. And I may be just be too much of a curmudgeon, that I kind of want something darker in the ending, or I'm too prepared, I'm mentally ready for a dark ending, and giving me an out-and-out happy ending, it wrong-foots me. I don't like it. I just like, no, be dark again, David. What are you doing?
Well, maybe you can say, you know, it's good that we have one film in David Lynch's filmography where we have that kind of thing. I think it's also, in that sense, a bit of a safe watch. I mean, I really enjoyed it this time. I remember, again, watching it many, many years ago. It does feel good to have a happy ending from David Lynch. You know, I like this film because it has this straightforward quality towards something that you know will turn out well, but along the way there will be horrible things that happen and horrible characters that appear, and this, again, this kaleidoscope of situations that are run into. I think I really like this journey. That's, I think, what I came out with thinking, including, you know, the music that is used. Obviously the Chris Isaak tune is probably the most famous, but also this Strauss music that was playing over the credits already, that the Elvis references repeatedly and so on. It felt like something I really like being put through, and it feels very rewarding at the end for those slightly naive elements that are in there. And at the same time, obviously, the culty characters and culty deaths and so on that are part of this. But it feels somehow you're safe in this world if you're not Harry Dean Stanton or any one of the characters who are Willem Dafoe, you know, and you've been, you know, horrible in your life. But if you're the leads, you're somehow safe on that journey. And it feels good to have a film like that from David Lynch, I think.
No, I can sort of see that. And it is... I know people who are very critical of it, but it is also a film that has come back as people saying it's my favorite David Lynch film. And I think that probably gets to the heart of why. It has these Lynchian moments, but it then will give you the like you said, the La La Land ending. So it has that place in his catalogue of, yeah, and probably a good place to start in the sense of, okay, you've done the most sort of conventional ending. Now let's move on to some of his other films, which will be different.
Yeah, I think it gives him a certain range as well in his filmography. And I think, yeah, everyone who sees it for the first time will have to see if that's actually the type of Lynch film that they like, maybe that they would prefer for some of his others, or whether you really enjoy, of course, what he did most often, which was something much darker, much more ambiguous and much more shocking in parts. So Wild at Heart, certainly something to have two sides to fall on, if not more, in David Lynch's serve.
But I think we both agree, definitely watch it. If you haven't seen it,
yes,
or you haven't seen it for a while, it's worth a watch or a rewatch.
Definitely. I would say there are many, many good reasons to watch this, no matter what you come out with at the end. It was a great journey to go on, and I was open to really disliking it, and I ended up really liking it again. So I would say it's maybe not my favorite, but certainly among the films that I really enjoy by Lynch. Well, thank you, listeners, for joining us for this mini Second Chances, another David Lynch-related episode of our Damn Fine Espresso. Not the last one, I think. There's more in store, and also more in store in our Lost Summer. So keep listening and keep looking out for new episodes. Thank you, Alan, for joining me.
I really enjoyed it, and good to get one of the weaker David Lynch's, like, actually make peace with it.
Be at peace with Wild at Heart. I think that's what we should do. All right, listeners, check out our next episodes and join us again for a damn fine espresso. Bye-bye.
Bye.